This is Geek Speak, episode 39 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. I hear that we have a correction from last week.
Yes, indeed. I mentioned from a photo that was taken down by Facebook because it showed a prepubescent girl nude. And it was running from what I thought was the My Lai massacre. It was, in fact, after a correction from a listener, after napalm dropped by the South Vietnamese army from their planes.
So you got the war right, and it was horrendous.
Yes. But I was 4 years off the mark.
All right. Well, I do appreciate those kind of corrections, of course, because we're grabbing lots of stories. And so anytime you have...
And we're pedants. So if anyone wants to correct a pedant...
It's the best kind of correction.
Absolutely... Fair game.
Absolutely. And if you would like to correct us or add more to what we're talking about, you're welcome to do so by sending us a note. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, you can always just go to geekspeak.org to find out what our address is. All right, Miles, we got a whole bunch of stuff going on. And I guess what we're going to start with is a story from the Windy City. And this is a slightly sensitive topic in the sense that it talks about vibrators, sexual pleasures. And the internet, and that's why we're talking about. So give us the lowdown.
Right, and this is definitely into the zone of the Internet of Things and the consequences to having connected items where they did not have any intelligence and were not connecting before. There is a vibrator that is internet-capable.
Internet-capable vibrator.
Yes. Can connect via Bluetooth to a phone and can also... connect up over the internet so that, for example, and this is the goal to it, was so that a partner could choose to do different things if you can't be in the same place as your preferred partner. The only thing was that this device was also phoning home with usage information, which from a company point of view, saying like, hey, how is our product being used? Most of the time, we don't think about that as being that big of a deal. Some of us decide to opt out. Some of us don't. But like, people want to know how often my browser crashes. Okay, that's fine. This ends up being a bit more sensitive. No pun intended.
Mm-hmm. The data that's being sent, what kind of data are we talking about? When it's on and when it's off, right?
And also, like, what the intensity is, and
this is one of those vibrators that has multiple intensity settings. Almost all of them seem to do this now, right? Mm-hmm. Where they have the on-off, but then they have like a varying pulse. And of course, the reason for this is when you put a CPU in it instead of it just being analog circuitry. When it's a CPU and it's just pulse width modulation, you can do any pattern you want. You could do a song if you wanted to. And then, of course, all it really is a lopsided motor inside there. So a motor with a lopsided weight that spins around, and that causes the vibration. So the speed of the motor, which you can modulate by doing a pulse width modulation, which means a square wave that duration of on and off changes over time. And that ratio is how much intensity the motor gets, how much energy the motor gets, and therefore how fast it goes. And of course, you can kind of have it go just like the phones. In fact, the new iOS 10 has changed its vibration for a call. Have you noticed that? Have you upgraded yet?
I have upgraded. I hadn't really noticed. I've been kind of busy this past week, so
it used to be like a kind of thing, and now it's a so it's kind of a double beat. It's kind of neat. Anyway,
well, I have an older iPhone, so who knows if that got updated?
Yeah, my iPhone 6 Plus does it. So I don't know if
and it's, I have an iPhone 5, yeah, so several generations back.
Yeah, we'll have to play with it after the show. Okay, so this vibrator has multiple abilities in the sense that it has different rates and things like that. And I don't understand why you would want to control it with a phone. I mean, give me a reason for this purpose. Like, I mean, I'm not trying to be silly here. I'm not trying to be, like, you know, hard about this. But why would you want to do that?
I believe it had to do with sometimes you can't be in the same place or you want your partner
Does this vibrator somehow attach to the person? Let me see the picture.
It does get inserted, of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this vibrator has two pieces of vibration. There's kind of a small, thin piece and a larger piece, and it looks like kind of the lowercase letter N. Mm-hmm. And part of it, the smaller part, can be inserted into the vagina. And so you can actually wear it over your clitoral hood and over the entire, I don't know, front part of the vagina.
We are so, okay. What? We're so not qualified for this.
Okay. No, I think we're doing okay. I mean, maybe a warning of sexual, explicit material, kind
of. Probably would have been helpful, yeah.
But I don't think we're outside the scope of what we would talk about.
Right.
Maybe on the show.
No, yeah.
I might feel more comfortable with doctors on the show talking about it. In any case, so if you could wear this thing, then I could see a partner of yours controlling it could be kind of an interesting side effect. I think I saw a movie with this as one of the themes. And, of course, the remote control that got lost at the party and everybody was pushing the buttons on it. So I can now see a reason for this hands-off control.
Of course, this assumes this is inserted into the vagina as opposed to the
– anywhere else. I don't understand something. How would you if you wanted this feature set, how would you implement this without a phoning home service capability? You want to be able to control it from anywhere, right?
Right. That's the thing, though. They're talking about it keeps – well, I could see connecting up to a phone via Bluetooth. That's a short distance.
Short range. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, this thing comes with a remote control as well.
Right, and then you'd have to pair first. And then if you were to say, okay, I want to be able to connect up with a remote partner, then using the servers as a pass-through. From web technology, I know that there's things you can do, but that's not going to be the case for an embedded device like this.
No.
God, I feel dirty every single time I say, like, use the terminology of tech, an embedded device.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of puns here.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you wanted to remotely control it, long distance outside of the Bluetooth range, connected to the internet and having an intermediary always on makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to go highly private, of course, you could set up the device to phone to a private IP, which you then controlled. And if we were to invent a device like this, we might do that route.
Right. But one of the issues with this is every time you get into that, let's do it the most private way possible, the difficulty level for the end user starts to
explode.
Spike.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite a bit. And so there's a reason for convenience sake to have this server connected. The class action suit that's going along with it is that they believe that they're storing this sensitive information without the user's express consent.
Right.
That would be date and time and what the settings are and the like. And all of this information that's being sent out would only be useful if you were doing it over a long distance with someone else where you had to have that internet connection. If you weren't doing the internet connection, there is no reason to have that transmitted out there that I can think of.
I don't know. I guess there's a reason for the feature. It's not a feature that I would be looking for as a customer, I have to say.
I do have to say, though, that I do want to apologize to our audience because I'm referring to things as though they're naughty bits. I don't mean to have that in there. It's just outside of our range of normal programming.
Absolutely.
And so I didn't want to make people unnecessarily uncomfortable.
Yeah. Like tracking their sexual exploits
like
on the website.
Yeah.
It's true that it's a little bit touchy of a subject. And see, it's very hard not to make a pun on this. It's tricky to talk about this.
It's like we're back in eighth grade.
Yeah. It's tricky to talk about this appropriately. And I do wish we kind of had a medical practitioner on because, of course, they talk about this kind of stuff so much that it's easy for them to chat. But I think that talking about where tech hits the boundaries of privacy, and this is right in there, you know, in the privacy aspect, is an important thing for us to do because you're not going to hear this on the general media, right? You're not going to hear this on Fox News. And the whole idea of talking about what it actually – how it works and stuff, where are you going to have a good technical debate about this?
Right.
It's not going to be in public media. I mean, this is the spot. So if we can actually chat about this without giggling and being silly, I think we're doing a great service. So was there anything else we wanted to cover about that?
Wait, does that mean that we passed or failed that test?
I don't know. I think that we're – you and I are –
I think you did a lot better than I did.
I think that you and I are programmed to – you know, try to find a second meaning in everything that's said so we can kind of tease and joke about it.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to do that in sexual terms. Of course, in talking about sex, there's a lot of words that have a double entendre because you want to use a vocabulary that's rich and robust, and it's also something that's slightly sensitive to talk about. So we use metaphoric language all the time with sex.
Right.
And therefore so many words become a double meaning when you're talking about sexual.
Well, and let's be honest, the computers in general and in many of the topics that we talk about are I can't think of many more asexual topics to bring up. Like, it really ends up being cold and analytical and not personal.
Yeah, it's true.
And so, maybe that's why we seek out all of those double entendres to bring that humanity back in. Who knows?
I'm just taking a look at this vibrator that we were talking about. It's called the Wii Vibe. I'm not sure what version of it is, but there's actually quite a bit of reviews on it on different sites that talk about this kind of things. And it has high marks. Quality 5 stars. So there's different, you know, ratings of this device. Now, they're not rating and talking about the Bluetooth one. I haven't seen any other reviews of this, just this potential class action lawsuit. I think it's phenomenal to my mind that – okay, first off, this company is obviously innovating, right? They have it – it's completely – the stand recharges the system. It all is through – you don't have to plug the devices in. They're completely silicon-coated so that they don't have any ability for liquids and stuff to damage the batteries. You don't have a cable or anything. It's completely sealed. And so it does induction charging, which is really cool. The remote control also is inductive charging. That's great. Clearly, this company is innovating. But I find it fascinating – and kind of horrible that the company hasn't figured out a way to, as they're moving into the Internet of Things space, not figure out how important it is to keep this information private.
Well, in their defense, I also think of the analog of Internet Explorer back in the day. People talked, and myself included, gave Internet Explorer a really hard time with regard to its security model.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, a lot of the a lot of the issues, a lot of the exploits that came about that were really taking Internet Explorer 6.0 to task and the like,
mm-hmm.
didn't exist.
You mean there wasn't any exploits in the wild of the problems that existed?
It was a class of problem, like by putting in this web browser, getting all these computers onto the internet, getting to a permanently connected connection. You know, let alone from when modem days.
Sure.
And all these things that had not been done before and with technologies like what you were introducing with plugins into the browser that you just – no one even realized that they were on the roadmap yet.
Right.
You have to protect against this exploit. What? No researcher had even hypothesized that the exploit existed yet.
Yeah. It's a bit of a Monday morning quarterback kind of routine of going, well, you should do this.
Right.
And of course
– Now, should the company improve on their product? I believe yes. I believe that is beholden upon them to do so. But I don't want to just slam them for that. I think this is going to be the case in a lot of what we call the Internet of Things, where we need to nail down the unintended consequences of connecting all of these previously unconnected devices.
One of the things in this lawsuit is talking about how the woman that purchased it would never have purchased it if she had known that in order to use its full functionality, you'd have to create an account and hadn't connect up, right? So it has actually limited capabilities without connecting your phone to it. That's pretty devious. All right, let's move on.
Sure. Pluto is emitting X-rays.
Pluto is emitting X-rays,
right,
that we didn't know about before.
Well, it just – yeah, we weren't expecting that.
We just detected
that.
That's interesting. Do we know why?
No. That's like so exciting.
That is pretty exciting. All right, cool. How much X-rays? Like more than other bodies?
Well, the thing is it shouldn't be according to our current model of the solar system, at least not to
– Oh, I love – this is a totally unknown, is what you're saying. That's funny because it's an entity that's relatively close compared to other things we've been studying.
It's so far from the sun, that highly energized particles doing that to the level we'd be detecting the X-rays, coming up from interactions just doesn't seem likely.
You mean like what's the energy source that's actually producing the X-rays?
Yeah.
Aliens? No, I'm just kidding. That's really cool. I look forward to it. But we know no theories yet about what's actually causing this?
Well, I'm sure people have many theories. I don't.
But nothing substantial.
I am both not qualified to comment on the viability of any of those theories, and two, I'm also not well versed enough to know what everyone is saying.
Sure.
in that model.
This last week, Apple actually finally allowed people to start purchasing their new iPhone and also their new watch, the iPhone 7, and one of the thing that I've heard the most about the iPhone 7 is its inability to plug an analog headphone into it. It does not have a headphone jack, as you well know, Miles, as probably all of our listeners know. But the other thing is, of course, the Galaxy, which is a phone by Samsung?
Yeah, the Galaxy Note 7, yeah, by Samsung.
And it's comparable in size, and the 5 at least.
To the iPhone 7 Plus, yeah.
That's right. The benefit, of course, of it is that it actually has a stylus. The iPhone 7 does not have a stylus, which in my mind is kind of silly in the sense that it's pretty big. And I think the Galaxy 6, a friend had, and it was pretty cool to be able to draw on it, take notes. Yeah. Anyway, it, of course, had a little bit of a recall problem because it was catching on fire.
Not just catching on fire, like literally exploding.
Exploding, like the battery that I charged in my flashlight and it exploded.
Right, including in like people's pockets.
Just exploding. Josh Mavine wrote a funny little tweet. The iPhone doesn't have a headphone jack, but the Galaxy literally explodes. Is a perfect metaphor for this election. Which you sent me. I laughed. I thought that was pretty funny.
The criticisms of Hillary Clinton tend to be more procedural. Like, I don't like this specific thing. It's important to me to have it. And at the same time, the other alternative literally explodes in your pants and you get burned as you're trying to get it out.
So you equated the iPhone 7 with Hillary and Trump with the Galaxy?
Yes.
You could do it either direction, couldn't you?
Not so much.
Well, isn't that just your political opinion?
No, not so much. If you took a list of all of the insane things that both candidates have said, one candidate stands out for the sheer number and intensity of insane things.
Okay. What's the feature that – I don't want to get in political about this. It was kind of funny. But I do want to mention that I did purchase an iPhone 7. Of course, I've ordered it and I won't actually get it till next month. I don't have a big problem with it. Keep in mind that I care about headphones. In fact, with last week's episode, I actually messed up on and didn't bump the levels high enough when I exported it. But normally I double check things. And one of the things I'll check, especially if I'm concerned about part of the audio, is I'll actually encode it to MP3 and put it on my iPhone and plug in good headphones. And from that point – kind of master the quality and make sure it's okay. And in doing that, of course, analog headphones are a necessity because the little earbuds that you get and even Bluetooth in general are not high enough quality or don't have the same envelope of sound which the headphones I'm used to have. And so
I can't tell the differences. Would that be fidelity?
Yeah, I would say – I mean fidelity denotes that there's something wrong with
their
sound.
They don't sound enough like the Sony Reference headphones?
That's the thing. Yeah. I like the Sony Reference headphones because I know the quality of other shows and such by that. In any case, the iPhone 7 comes – this is what the news did not cover – comes with a lightning to analog 1/8-inch adapter. So
no, the news has been covering that. But it's just another dongle that people have to carry.
It's a dongle, but it's a pretty small dongle. And you have to carry your headphones anyway. So you find your best headphones, you attach it, and you never remove it from them. I mean, you're done. It doesn't feel like a big burden to me.
It seems very much like, to me anyway, the how many laptops have the HDMI out. And modern MacBook Pros do now too. But when they were first being released, the MacBook Pro, the unibodies that is, they only had the mini display port. And so you had to have a dongle to connect up to an external monitor everywhere. And – you know, it kind of bothers you to have to carry yet another thing, especially when it's a phone, because then you always have it connected to the headphones. You can do that if you only ever use those headphones with your phone.
Right. What you're saying is you're going along between work and home, and one place has the dongle and the other place has an extra pair of headphones. You can't use them. Mm-hmm. So pretty soon you have to have – yeah, I can see that.
Now, that said – even though I don't have an iPhone 7, it's really a non-issue. It would be a non-issue for me because I do listen by Bluetooth.
Yeah.
And perhaps I'm not an audiophile, but I find the audio to be perfectly acceptable.
What are you connecting the device up to? What type of Bluetooth receiver do you have? Like a small speaker or house system?
No, headphones.
Oh, headphones.
Yeah.
What kind of headphones? Over the ear or in bed? Okay.
Well, they're over the ear, over the neck.
Yeah, I've got a pair of those. I like those. Mine are actually exercise. So whenever I'm like on a treadmill or something, I'll use those because if you sweat, you don't want to damage the headphones. And these are designed specifically for that. The audio quality is not as good, and you could hear it if you A-B tested it. But when do you A-B test it?
Right.
You
know? That's kind of along the lines of when people have told me this was back in the day. Sean Cleveland was always telling me, like, you look at a 1080p monitor, and it looks so much better than a 720. Like it's a really big difference and very big difference from DVD. And it was. If you look side by side, it's a clear difference. Mm-hmm. at the same time, it's like, but I just want to watch, you know, Fantasia, and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, we are very good at accepting and getting used to the experience we're in. Our light adaption is a perfect example of that. During the day, the blue light of the sun, if you will, the bluer light of the sun, looks normal and everything looks white. And at night, everything's yellow in an incandescent house and it looks normal and white. Like, we are very good at adjusting to an environment. That's kind of one of the things we do. So that you don't have
a problem. Or
rather,
our vision is completely just a concoction of our brain, not necessarily based
as is our
reality. Yeah.
As is our perception of sound.
Yes.
Right? So you can... You'll hear a lot. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and sometimes you'll get a relatively well-renowned podcast or radio show talking to the guest, and the guest is via phone. And a phone connection is just a really bad audio quality. And yet, as you listen to it over a period of time, you don't notice it. Like, you just get used to that being the sound of the person that you're talking to.
Now, this is not to take away from someone who does – everyone has their thing that bugs them. If the quality is not to their liking or has some aspect to it that that just kind of pokes at them. For geeks, a lot of times it's saying like, hey, why is this video stuttering, you know, at this particular point? Why does it always have to do that? And I remember setting up like home theaters and something would skip or the sound would be a little bit off and I'd go like, oh, and everyone around was like, just sit down. We're enjoying ourselves. It doesn't matter. Like,
right.
We can.
Let's go on to another Apple update, but this one's a little older, or I should say, yeah.
Well, it's a new update.
It's a new update for an older product.
Yes. So we all know about the Macintosh. I mean, they're, if you count the point releases, far more than 10 revisions of Mac OS.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, this operating system is not about that. This operating system is for a computer from a long bygone era.
Before Macintosh is what you're saying?
Yes, a computer that was released 30 years ago. Or at least the Apple II GS was released 32 years ago.
There were
older ones, the Apple II, Apple IIe, that were released earlier. And they ran
ProDOS. Wait, Apple is releasing an update to the Apple II?
Apple is not.
Okay, sorry.
Apple, I can't even get Apple to release an update for my original iPad.
So what's the operating system for the Apple II?
ProDOS.
ProDOS, okay.
And
who wrote it? Is that a Woz thing?
A very devoted developer. No, just
– No, I meant the actual original operating system. Was it an Apple – it was an Apple product? You think it was Woz? I'm assuming it was
Woz. I'm sure he had some input into it, but
so
at the same time –
So somebody else grabbed the source code somehow and rewrote – what are they doing?
Yeah, they patched it, started making changes. A lot of the stuff was written in assembly language, so – and do some hacks on it and then patch into existing libraries.
So what did they do? What kind of changes did they make to it?
Well, let me just say that I'm not really that familiar and I'm not a big connoisseur of the Apple II.
Did you ever have one?
I actually never did.
Mm-hmm. I had
friends
one.
Who did.
Actually, my grandparents had one, so I used it a lot.
I did use one in school very briefly, you know, lemonade, the lemonade stand and
what was the helicopter one where you flew a helicopter and landed?
And
then there was also
I've forgotten.
Missile Commander was on there, and anyway, those were the games I remember very well.
Oregon Trail, I guess was the other one I was thinking of. So this is not a huge amount of code by modern day standards. This is not like the Linux kernel, which is millions of lines of code, or Windows, which is, you know, tens of millions of lines of code. We're talking about something that fits on a single old-school floppy, a boot utility that's under 400 bytes,
wow,
which is less than a single block of storage on modern disks.
Well, operating system fit in that?
Yeah, it runs in less than a kilobyte of RAM.
Here's an interesting fact, too. The Apple II system and the Apple II Plus didn't support lowercase characters. We're talking
that's,
about...
That's not exactly true.
Oh, okay.
They did, but you had to do some interesting hacks. Like the basic display didn't, but there were programs that did use uppercase and lowercase.
Wow. it's interesting. If you want to play with the DOS, the Pro DOS 2.4, you can play it in a web emulator, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So if you want to, like, remember the whole experience of it.
And it all fits on a 140K 2.25-inch disk image. A true floppy disk from...
Five and a quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Back when they still were floppies.
Yeah, and this project to release the next version, the newest version, is by John Brooks, and clearly, definitely a labor of love to get all that working. So awesome.
You have to want to do something like this because you're not going to do it by obligation. There's just no way.
So let's see. The 2.4... It does – what does it actually produce? What does it produce? What does it actually create?
A basic interpreter, disk imaging, so formatting disks. And I don't know if it has USB support or not, but it does have a compression-decompression utility on there.
It's so cool, and it's totally available for download. It's just so great. A whole write-up on all the different features it has. Fantastic. And also there's feature difference in between the Apple II GS and the Apple II because they do have different capabilities. So right. He actually produced it. It works on either.
Right. And this is the first update to that computer's operating system since 1993.
Oh, man. Oh, and there's some really good benefits here. Bitsy Byte, which is a little extra thing, allows drives to be selected directly by slot number using the keys 1 through 7, allows files to be selected by the typing the first letter in their file name, and it'll autocomplete. This really fast scrolling, that's pretty cool. So really serious
stuff we would have really loved 30 years ago.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Nicely done, sir. Thank you so much for producing that.
Yes, that was
John Brooks.
Yeah, John Brooks is the software developer who did this.
All right, moving on. I have a suggestion for a little app that I thought you might like. I know that there's a lot of listeners that do not have Macintoshes or iPhones, and I'm sorry that we go down this road so much. I work on iOS as one of my primary roles. Lately, I've been doing development on the TV product.
Yeah. Which kind I of, do have Android tablets.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing more website and TV development work, but mostly I do iOS. In any case, iOS 10, which I've been running on my phone for a while, has an ability to do sticker pack. And when Apple made this big announcement, I can't remember who it was that talked about it at their big keynote thing about the operating system, they really prompted, you know, how great this is. All they are is the ability to take animated GIFs basically and drop them into the existing messaging texting service that they have and place them wherever you want. So as you and I are chatting, I can take a picture of like a flying pig and put it above what you last said, right? And that's about the gist of it. So it's kind of like emojis, but they're much more rich. Well, and it allows developers to produce sticker packs of different types.
When you say that's just about it, one of the big issues with texting and email and the like is that you lose that in-person nuance.
Yep.
And so anything that can reintroduce some of this, if it's whimsical or playful or the like, that all the better for it, I think.
I think one of the trouble I have with this, though, is that if you and I are chatting and you're on your Android device and we're texting, what we're actually doing, if I'm using Messenger or iMessage on my phone and I'm sending you a text message, it gets translated via text. It's going to be a text message from your side. Mm-hmm. So that emoji smiley face might just be characters, the colon and so on. It might be a translation that way. Or it might be that it's actually emoji character that hopefully your phone can read. Most likely it will be able to. These sticker pack things that I, on my screen, drop above a word that I said, hey, Miles, we should go down to the river and go for a walk with the dogs. And then I put maybe like a little smiley face on it to denote that I was kind of joking or some kind of reference.
Or the tongue out, yeah.
Yeah, tongue out being there.
Tongue out wink, yeah.
Yeah. That I was like teasing you or something because your dog ran away or something like that, right? I'm kind of inferring some other meaning with that.
Well, that would be really mean.
Yeah, it would be mean. I was trying to think of something that wouldn't be mean. And then what you would see on an Android device, though, would be me saying all that stuff and then that same picture showing up as a picture, not in the context of where I tried to place it on my screen. So what you're going to see versus what I see are different, and therefore miscommunication is more possible
right.
and probable. That being said, since we're both iOS developers, there is a great app called Grammar Snob, which Brian and I both thought of you for. And it's a sticker pack, which is just a whole bunch of like red pencil corrections that you can drop on top of what somebody else wrote to you. So two forms of the its contraction, or its and its. And a crossout mark. So you can drop a crossout mark on what I've said and then drop above that off of it with a little – with a caret to denote that, you know, insert here the actual correct spelling.
This is precisely the form of pedantry up with which I will not put.
No. I'm thinking I might have to buy this app for you so I can experience you doing this to me. It's fantastic. So let me know when you're on iOS 10.
We wouldn't be able to like get anything done.
Great. And I've been taking screen captures of your pedantry. Delicious. All right. Moving on. I have a Nissan Leaf. I've had it for about a year. It's a fully electric vehicle, over a year. I drive it whenever I get a chance. Anytime that we equate that during the travels we don't need more than the five seats it has and we don't need the distance of over 100 miles, I'll take that vehicle because it's a blast to drive. I feel better about driving it. It's quieter. There's no shifting problems. I mean, so many features of that vehicle I absolutely love. Right.
For folks out there, it's very much like when I got my Prius. 16 years ago or something ridiculous like that.
You didn't get that long ago.
I did.
No way. You got the Prius when you moved up from Santa Cruz?
Yes.
Wow.
I got it in the year 2000. It was a 2001 model.
The year 2000. Yeah. So when we started GeekSpeak, you got it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I started GeekSpeak before I got the car, though. Just barely. But I would giggle whenever I hit a stop sign because the engine would shut off. Oh. And I'd just be like, And you got into the car and went like, this is the future of cars. This
Absolutely.
Is what cars are going to be like. And many of them were. Many of them stayed much the same. But still, that infotainment, that screen that shows up is now showing up everywhere. And I got into your Leaf and finding you doing the same thing, just like, oh, look, I get into the car and I'm about to get pull out of my spot and there's cameras on every side showing you a view so you don't run into anything.
It's probably one of the best features, actually, is that kind of forced perspective. It looks like there's a camera above you shooting from above, but really it's four stitched photos together digitally and then it looks like you can see the view on the vehicle. Yeah. And you can, effectively.
Right.
It's really cool.
And then you go home and then you plug it in.
And plug it in. I never visit a gas station. I do visit a gas station sometimes when I've got like need to get like tires filled.
Or if you're driving the minivan.
Well, yeah. So they have the second vehicle, which is this big gas cluster. Anyway, the one trouble with it is if I'm going to go to the city and do like museum day up in the city, I haven't done that in Leaf. I can get up there. But I have to charge all day before I can get home or charge enough time to be able to get home again. So, you know, I didn't do that last couple times I went to the city. We always take another vehicle. And that's kind of a bummer. And that has to do with the 100-mile range. Now, if you have a Tesla, if you have enough money for that, Tesla's got like 300-mile range.
Right.
And that would change.
Which has started at like $60,000, $70,000 and then goes upward to quickly. Like $120,000 for your car. If you can afford it, like if you're wealthy enough where you're like, I could get a Leaf or I could get a Tesla. It doesn't really matter. It's a rounding error. If you're rich enough that you can say that, then hey, no
Tesla
problem.
Tesla is. Yeah, sure.
If you're not, then, well, you have to look at other options. One of those other options is the Chevrolet Bolt. I wanted to give
– And you're not saying the Volt. You're saying the Bolt.
The Bolt, right. The Bolt is a hybrid, whereas – yeah, the Volt is the hybrid. The Bolt is the all-electric.
Which is not out yet. They just announced it. And please, I want to cringe when you tell me this. What's its range?
238 miles, as estimated by the EPA.
And they also say it's going to be – they don't have the actual price yet, but the assessment is it's going to be the same price range as the Leaf.
Right. It was something like 37, and then with all the tax breaks and stuff like that.
Why did you let me purchase the vehicle instead of lease the vehicle, Miles? Why did you let me do that?
What are you talking about? How much use have you gotten out of that vehicle?
Tons. Why didn't I just lease it? If I leased it, then I could like, you know, turn it in and get the Bolt.
Whatever, dude.
First world problems. So 238-mile range. I hope that vehicle's as good as it sounds.
Right. Now, a drawback with regard to Teslas is you don't get like the supercharger network. But although I don't know the compatibility. Like, what do you do with your Leaf? Where do you charge? Do you only ever charge up at home or do you try to charge up at stations out and about?
I charge at stations out and about. There are effectively – effectively, there's two charging types. There's Teslas and there's the other one everyone uses. That being said, that simplifies it quite a bit. But if you see like an EV charging station, if it doesn't say Tesla on it, it's for all the other cars. Mm-hmm. Tesla also can charge with one of those. So additionally, Tesla's charging stations, which are for Tesla, are free for Tesla drivers. So that's kind of odd. I guess if you spend that much, what the heck? And then my Leaf actually was the kind of the high-end vehicle, and it also has a high-end charging station. That charging station has to be at a three-phase power place that can produce enough DC and current. And I've never used it, but I do have a secondary port, and that port will charge my car at the same type of rate as the Tesla charging station is, but it's very infrequent. I think there's 10 in the state or something like that. I won't quote the numbers.
So speaking of someone who doesn't have an electric car, talking to someone who does.
Sure.
When you go to charge up your vehicle, like what are the charges involved? What's the...
So you basically pay for kilowatt hour. My vehicle goes about 4 miles per kilowatt hour. So a kilowatt hour is 1,000 watts over an hour, right? If you took 10 bright light bulbs and turn them on for an hour, that much electricity transfers me 4 miles. Kilowatt hour is like, 11 to 12 cents if it's at home. Depends on your rate. Mm-hmm. You can look in your phone bill and see what it is depending on where you are. At a charging station that you pay for, like there's one in Scotts Valley next to the Walgreens, there I think it's 75 cents per kilowatt hour. So it's more expensive there. That gives me 4 miles. That's pretty pricey.
Yeah, I was about to say, that ceases to be cheaper than gasoline.
Right. But at home, I'm paying 11 cents for 4 miles. So that's the equation.
Okay.
Additionally, there's charging stations at the office I work at Netflix, and those charging stations are provided. And so whenever I drive to work, I get to charge for free, which is probably a major reason why I bought the vehicle. I have to say. And we actually have a lot of electric vehicles here at the Netflix office in Los Gatos.
Yeah. So we'll see how it works out. GM has said that 30 minutes on their better chargers, which is not it's not like a supercharging thing like Tesla, but one of their combined charging system protocols, the ones that you were talking about, like everyone supports, they can get a 90 miles of range in 30 minutes.
Yeah. So there's the charging stations that you can get. You can get one that runs off of 110 volt, and normally you actually just get that when you get the vehicle. It's like a backup charging station, and this is just a normal home Edison plug. You could plug in with the three-prong thing, and at the end of that, it plugs into your car. And that can charge at a slower rate. You can also get a home unit that runs off 240 because, of course, homes have 220, 240, depending on how you talk about it, voltage, and then you're getting a little bit higher and faster rate. I have never done that at my house. I rent my house, so I haven't made the modification to the house to do that. It takes me to charge like a full charge. It takes like 10 hours. So I don't use all the charge in one day. But if I drove all day long until I ran out of electricity, then went home and charged, it would be like 10 hours before I could actually have a full charge. Out in the world, though, it's much shorter than that because I can go find the 240-volt charging stations. That's probably enough about electricity and cars. Are you going to get one of these?
I don't think so, but... my mom's car is getting older. She may get one.
I want to play with one, but I might not buy one myself.
Well, if I were in the market for another one, but the thing is, we have a minivan, and I wish there were like hybrid minivans or electric minivans, but don't exist.
There is a Tesla vehicle that sort of seats six.
One that costs less than $100,000.
All right, okay, fine. I see. okay. Cool. Hey, if you want to give us feedback, as I said at the beginning of the show, you're welcome to do so by just sending us email. We're geeks at geekspeak.org. Of course, you can also visit geekspeak.org. Every show we talk about, all the topics we talk about, we put up on the website. And that's also in the RSS feed. If you're subscribed to us, which I hope you are through one of the many subscription services, but of course, you're actually your client, your iTunes, your podcasting client is actually hitting our website all the time and getting our RSS file. And inside that RSS file in the show notes are all the links we're talking about as well. So you can read the article directly from Ars Technica about the Chevy Bolt. Excuse me. What's going on in New York, specifically the police department?
One of the things it's very controversial around the country. New York City is no different in this regard. But if the police find a large amount of cash in your possession.
Mm-hmm.
To get that cash back, you oftentimes have to sue the city. And then by doing so, you have to produce documentation as to where the cash came from, that it was not gained from illicit means.
Wait. If I have cash,
if you're driving
on
along
me,
and you have like $60,000 of cash.
Okay. Which would be weird, but possible, I guess. And then I'm pulled over and searched for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Then they find that cash. They won't just like ask me where it's from. They'll just take it and say, this is the paperwork for you.
Exactly.
To get
back. Well, no, they won't tell you here's the paperwork. You have to then sue to retrieve it.
Wow.
It's civil forfeiture is the term for it. And one of the things about – and this story comes about New York City. One of the issues with it is that people have been asking, how much money are you getting in from this?
Yeah.
This money from evidence.
How much money
– the reason this came about, just to give people some background because they may not be familiar with it as you
please,
don't seem to
give
be,
me some background. Yeah.
Was the war on drugs. You had a lot of drug dealers and large amounts of cash, and one of the ways to stem that flow was to take the money out of that.
Just always take the cash. That
right.
makes sense in some regards if you're doing
and
that.
When you sue to say, I want this money back, if you can say, this is where I got it from, this is – I got it from my ATM, like I pulled it out of this account and it's mine, then presumably you get it back. But mm-hmm. a drug dealer would have no such paper trail and would not be able to get it back.
Let me stop you here for just a second. What is the minimum – What's the point at which it becomes a lot, excessive amount? I mean, can I have $300 on me and it gets taken?
It depends upon if you're crossing a border, if you are, you know, crossing an international border, if you are getting off a plane.
I've seen like whenever you travel internationally, one of the forms you ask is, do you have more than $10,000 worth of value? Because that's the cap for traveling. For being in New York, is it $100? Is it $600? Is it $6,000? I mean, is it a figure that seems relatively reasonable to us in the sense that they won't take someone's $300?
I can't speak for individual incidents, mm-hmm. but it should be in the
thousands.
At
least. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Or 10,000,
So the request was, and Freedom of Information Act would be a perfect way to get this, hey, police department, how much money are you getting every year for this?
Right. And the New York City Police Department, who takes in literally millions of dollars in cash each year as evidence, are saying, we really have no idea how much money is in there. We can't tally it because if we try to run a query on our four-year-old computer system – not 40-year-old, four-year-old computer system that tracks evidence, it would cause the system to crash. Like I have to reboot,
what?
Start over again. And yeah, exactly. If you're coming from a programming background, this is a ridiculous statement on its face, and yet this is their public statement to the general public because they might get away with it. They might go like, that makes sense because
let me
try to translate
it. So you say, hey, I want to know how much money you're making, you know, getting. They don't want to tell you. So instead of saying, oh, let's figure out how to do that, they just lie about it. I mean,
on the contrary, it may very well be true. The issue here is that why in the world would it be acceptable to remain on a system that you would not be able to query? Now, the statement of we don't want to move, that's a whole other thing to say that. So we don't know that they're lying that it would cause the system to crash. It may very well be. Everyone has worked at a company that has been on a shoestring budget with regard to their infrastructure. And so you don't want to do certain things. And public facilities, government facilities in general, do run on shoestring budgets in many ways. A lot of their money goes to other things besides the infrastructure. And so it is entirely possible that is the case. It's just a matter of how can you possibly leave it that way when you know that you're going to have these Freedom of Information Act requests. Mm-hmm. And if you know that that's the case, except if you are saying, I want to avoid the liability of having to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the normal response from Freedom of Information Acts is this is too taxing. This is when we can get to it. It's a very common practice to say it's hard, it's expensive, it's challenging to do what you're asking, and therefore delay, delay, delay. And those are probably normally relatively valid. At the same time, it seems to me that since the Freedom of Information Act exists, producing a system in which you cannot rely, you know, rapidly respond to them seems like you're kind of doing an injustice just by producing that type of system.
Which I could see that if that was an ad hoc system, except this is a formal product made by SAP, the company SAP, called the Property and Evidence Tracking System, PETS.
There's no way that that's – if SAP made it within the last 4 years, there's no way that that system has a flaw like that.
Well, the hardware may be –
yeah, but I mean, like we're talking about a very simple query. Like what?
Yes.
maybe the issue at hand is that the evidence system is for evidence specifically, and so the issue is that they don't actually have a value column, and so now they have descriptors and they have to do some kind of search and sum, and they just don't have a good SQL programmer.
Which is ridiculous. If you're talking about a property and evidence tracking, not having a value column. Just from my mind, as just a basic level from programming, if I'm thinking like all the things
I get that.
That is ridiculous.
I'm sure SAP has that, but it's very possible that the module that they bought, that the police department got, didn't have the cache module. So what they've instead been doing is putting in a text field, $15,000, right? And so that is true that that's what it is, but there's actually no way to easily add all those values up. So there's reasons that SAP's system does not function the way you'd expect it to function because of the use case of using it. I'm saying that there's no way SAP, which is like the premier company that does software for businesses, like SAP is the top one, and below that is IBM, right? Like we're talking – or is that, who's the next one now?
Who knows? But yes, they are a large player.
Yeah, yeah. So
large
but
established
it's possible
player.
That they're using the software wrong. I think you should volunteer your time. I bet within like 6 hours you could do this query for them.
The thing is, what you were describing, I'm still stuck in my head going, if it's inputted as a text field and they're putting in like dollar amounts and like pound sterling
sentences.
Or euro and stuff like that, and you have to do the conversions, in my mind, like I'm looking at this going, that's still like regular expression goes through there and the memory required to keep a counter –
okay.
Is nothing.
Okay, wait a second.
The fact that this database wouldn't have a cursor is just that's completely out of the question.
it's actually true. They cannot sum the number. There's not enough space in the memory of the machine to actually sum this number. That's how big it is.
Okay. No, hold on. Let's stop here.
Umayl's getting angry.
Folks, when we are talking about efficiency of algorithms. Time-wise, some can take a while. Memory-wise, some is not a hard function to manage in memory.
It's not a memory problem at all. That's fun.
Imagine you're working at a ledger and you're having to add up all the numbers. With a human being, the biggest issue you might have is losing your place as to where you're adding. But you don't have to keep all those numbers in your head in order to find out how much money you spent in total. That's
Miles,
not the problem.
Miles, the New York Police Department says that you're wrong. That's fantastic. I'd love to hear the sum of that.
They submitted it to the Computer World Honors Awards Program in 2012 for, quote, those who use information technology to benefit society.
What do you mean they submitted what? What do you mean?
The New York Police Department with their property and evidence tracking system was submitted as an example of using information technology to benefit society because they put it in 2012 to replace their old evidence logging system, their paper-based
one. Do they mean that maybe they can give you all the information from 4 years to now, but they just can't do it from before when the system was horrible?
No, they can't tell you right now. How much did they get last year?
Well, that's not all that New York is doing incorrectly. Are you familiar with the WEZ or wireless emergency alerts?
Yes.
In California, we get them for amber alerts.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's happened here in the
– including the snafus where we got the amber alert at like 2:30 in the morning and
– like, well, sometimes that's totally appropriate for it to happen at that time. I mean that's when it happens.
It's –
So what occurs here, if you've opted in, and sometimes the carrier opts in for you, you will get a enhanced text message, effectively. It's equivalent to a text message. It doesn't come in a normal text message space. It comes as a beep. Your phone will beep, and the screen will have a little display on it. Depending on the operating system, it handles it different ways.
Sure.
Around the office, last time one went off, it was fantastic. The entire floor goes – it's just, and it's like slightly timed differently, and all the things are going off. Of course, everybody reads it. Everybody reads them. They see what's going on, and they theoretically can act on it. The Ambler Alert is a California-based thing, I believe. And
yes,
this is about child abductions. So the idea is that you want to quickly spread the information out that this vehicle, this license plate was seen with this child. If right. you see it, do something.
And later on, we can get into the fact that it actually hasn't saved many children, especially for the amount of money. And that money, if it were spent on social services, might actually be more effective. But that's
no. I think you're getting into it right now. Go on.
That's a whole.
How much money are we talking about? I mean, if it's a lot of money
to set up the Amber system, the Amber Alert system was.
There's a bill for it. I recall. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have the number right.
Well, we're not
in my
covering
head.
That exactly.
Huge though.
What we are covering is the wireless emergency alerts system, and it's used in three cases. The FCC says it's used in three cases. Amber alerts, alerts from the president. So if the president wants to make an announcement, it can be used. And involving immediate threats to safety. So maybe a coastal region,
anyone who has a cell phone in the San Bruno region when that gas pipeline exploded, that
perfect
would be
example.
A perfect example.
So that is what the wireless emergency alert system is for. And the thing about the wireless alert system is I mentioned for the Amber Alerts because that's what you see more often, at least in this area. It is a text message. It has text.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't support the ability to have a link. It doesn't support the ability to have an image. It is base level communication information. Which is kind of okay when you're talking about trying to spot a vehicle, right? Because the license number is really good for spotting that color of the vehicle can be used in description.
Mm-hmm.
So the other aspect of it is it's theoretically regional in its design, but it's not very filtered for region. So it's kind of like throwing paint at a map. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to kind of hit the region, but it's not really going to be the way you would think of regions. It's going to mm-hmm. be more spread than that. So in any case, what happened on September 19th was Brian Feldman wrote this in NewYorkMag.com. At around 8 o'clock in the morning, everyone or anyone in New York City who has an emergency alert system turned on got a blaring message on their smartphone. And the message said, unfortunately, a very wanted, Ahmad Khan Rahami, 28-year-old male. See media for pick. Call 911 if seen. That's the extent of the message.
Yeah. See media for pick, which is shorthand for
Google it.
Google it. Yeah.
Yeah. So effectively, what they basically said is, hey, if you see anybody that you think might match this man's name, which in some regard would be racial profiling just from name recognition.
It absolutely would be. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're 28-year-old. That's all you know. Be concerned. Right. So now, mm-hmm. I mean, I think some of the responses back, shout out. This is from Kenyatta.
Kenyatta cheese.
Shout out to my fellow brown persons who originally planned on taking the subway to the airport today with luggage. Basically saying, and of course, that's an obvious thing. If you're going to be in a situation where you're a male and, you know, around 28 and you've got maybe a look that looks maybe like this name. I mean, that's the thing is you don't know what people think.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden,
and
you're
people are woefully bad at identifying the age of people who are not of their own ethnicity.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. You're 12, right?
Woefully bad at identifying many features in addition to being able to identify distinguishing features. So that whole saying of, you know, all black people look alike, all white people look alike, whatever, there actually is some biological, psychological basis of that. That
yeah.
if you are mostly around white people, black people are not as distinct to you
right.
as if you were around a whole lot of black people in your life. Yourself are black.
And an easy way to do
and
this
vice
without
versa.
And the easy ways to see this kind of thing without having the sensitivity of racial it's hard for us to talk about race in society. But without talking about that, you can talk about just cats, right? If you go to a friend's cat house and they've got like three cats that are the same color or even similar in some ways, mm-hmm. there's no way you're going to be able to tell them apart. They can tell them apart instantaneously because mm-hmm. as you get familiar with a certain qualities that are distinct, you get better at recognizing them. You know, interior decorator is really good at recognizing what type of furniture. Like that's just what happens. And this is the same with racial traits as well. So,
which is, as an aside, a real shame that we still have so many segregated neighborhoods.
Right. Because if you if you don't have the segregation problem, then you get more used to recognizing people's qualities for different purposes rather than generic, distance shots.
But it also brings up this fact that when there are incidents of public discord, maybe not like this bombing, but there are other things that happen in any major metropolitan city. It's curious that this is the one that is chosen for the big message. Like how often would you see a message that says, Adam Smith is a 25-year-old male with, short hair and some facial hair, and he's wanted in connection with a bank robbery down the street. Like it would seem it would be incredible to
– It's ridiculous.
Yeah, to put that up there.
But also in New York. In New York it's ridiculous. I mean if you put it in a situation where there was a unique quality of somebody you could describe somehow, 15-foot man in Nebraska wanted for police questioning. Like that at some level kind of makes sense because at least you have distinct figure. It's like there's not many 15-foot-tall people. But when you're talking about like a city of New York, it's not useful at all.
Yeah, you can't even identify like, oh, it's the nappy-headed Asian who speaks Spanish. Like which one?
Oh, man. So the question then becomes, well, what if we retooled the WEA system, this emergency alert system, so that images could be sent? Because, of course, our phones can handle that, right? It wouldn't be that hard. Would that be better or worse?
No. What you're doing is you're effectively deputizing the greater New York area, like one of the major metropolitan areas of the world, to say, hey, we're going to do this massive manhunt.
Right.
And without giving you enough context with the phone, and just it gives that a sense of uncertainty, and that's really a mob rule you don't want to get into.
The other aspect of this that I think is important, the Amber Alert system was not just about spreading the news to the individual person, you and me. It was also to spread the news between police departments. It's actually not very easy for different department systems to talk to each other, right? So the faster you spread news between police force, the better. I mean, I would think that would make a lot of sense.
Which is just ridiculous on its face.
Exactly. Like this situation, to some degree, would make more sense if you weren't deputizing the city of New York, right? If you were just saying, hey, all police and maybe other people that have had training about – I mean, not that the police necessarily are having training about, seeing people for who they are or whatever. But I could imagine using a technology like this with pictures – that could quickly spread for important information so that all the boroughs, police departments could be communicating well. That makes sense to me. But having the public be involved in it seems like you're just going to play on the fears of people.
Once you get to the range that they were talking about, which is hitting the entire – like all the boroughs of New York, it becomes noise.
Yeah.
Like you have no idea what you're talking about. If it, on the other hand, is something like there's an explosion in – this particular area. So let's send a blast out to all the phones connected to cell towers within a multi-block
radius.
Which
is what it can do to some degree, but yes.
Watch it. That would be something I could say like, this is an active thing.
Well, that's
does anyone know where that is?
But that matches one of the criteria. Message from the president, Amber Alert, child abduction, and the third one is imminent danger, right? Emergency system where you're in danger. That totally makes sense. This situation doesn't have any of those things. This is just a person wanted, right? It's not – and maybe you could say, well, it is imminent danger. We know this person has a nuclear weapon and they're roaming or something.
Except they don't. Yeah.
Well, but I'm trying to say like you could theoretically use it where you're just asking for people to look for a name. But even the structure of saying here's a person's name, go look for the picture on the internet for that person's name is stupid at face value, because in 20 minutes, we could produce a fake image that would get better hits, right? Like it's just not a good use.
Right.
If you instead did not have any names at all and you said something like, we're looking for someone, go up here and, I just can't see how it would work. I can't see how you could do that. At the same time, I think looking for a license plate and a vehicle description, I'm not so opposed to that for the Amber Alerts. That's normally what's followed, right? This person, looking for this person last seen in a Jeep Cherokee of this, this license plate number. In that regard, at least you're taking a lot of judgment about it away. You're just looking for an item, a thing, and not a human.
Right.
So it's a little bit better. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just tell them that the geeks say hi. Hey, I want to thank our patrons, which I do very clearly at the beginning of every month. I also want to thank our intern Chandler, who takes care of our website for us. And of course, our Canadian geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title. Wii Vibes update increases battery range to reach New York. And thank you, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, who provided our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 39 of season 16. Miles Elam, I appreciate you coming down to the office and doing this with me.
Always a pleasure.
You seriously have no post-show? We always have post-show.
Other than the fact that I'd like to use nightly versions of browsers.
Yeah, I noticed that. You were getting alerts all throughout the show. Your browser was kept on coming up with a message saying,
right.
problem.
Well, one of the things about browsers in general is that they're constantly changing. They're constantly getting new technology. And I could, if I wanted to try out some new technique, go into the settings and enable a feature that wasn't quite ready yet, or mm-hmm. They have behind a flag, or I could just get the newer version and just keep updating and just be a couple revisions ahead. If there's a bug in the browser, I can usually get around it. I know to update on a regular basis, so I usually do update my browser every day.
You do?
Or every other day. Yeah, pretty close.
Don't the browsers automatically update for us at this point?
But that's the thing. You still have to say, okay, it'll notify you, and then you still have to say, okay, go and update.
Okay.
But it hasn't really been a problem. I've actually been very impressed with the stability of the various browsers in their daily builds.
Mm-hmm.
I got unlucky this evening. And so my nightly build of Firefox, and they bumped up a revision number, which means they
– a little bit more.
They got a whole bunch of new pushes in.
Do you mean it did a minor version rather than a patch version, or –
No, they went from version 51 to 52.
Okay, so a major version.
Yeah. And so the thing is, you start to the new version, you start applying patches to it, and then you jump to the new version and throw in a whole bunch of new features. You know, so even among nightlies, this was a bit difficult. Firefox has added in what they call electrolysis, which is like what Chrome does. Each tab is its own process,
uh-huh.
so it doesn't take down the whole browser.
This means it's more memory bloaty when you're running multiple tabs.
That's in theory, yeah. But yeah.
But it does mean that your entire browser doesn't die at once, which is nice.
Right. But the tabs were dying on a regular basis, so yeah.
Well, that's where you're bleeding edge, man. It was still a smooth
show. It's what I asked for.
So since we don't have a lot of post-show, can we talk about Semver for a second? Do you know much about Semver?
Semver.
Semantic versioning.
Ah, yes.
Semver.org if you're interested. It's Semver.org, and I'll link that to geekspeak.org as well. Semver is basically kind of a contract you make in versioning software. It's extremely important when you do library usage, and the Node community has fully embraced Semver ideas, so that if I want to include a Node module from somebody else, I can say, I want to include this version, I've tested it, and I say this version and this major and minor and this patch, and I'll get into that in a second. And I can safely assume that as they bump the versions, I can keep on grabbing the most recent unless one of the minor or the major changes, specifically the major changes, and it will still be backwards compatible. So here's the idea. A Semver version is three different numbers with dots in between. So 2.1.3. The first number, like in Firefox, you said 56?
52.
52 is called the major number. And in full applications, this is not so important. In libraries and modules, this is very important, this idea. So the major version means we have changed things. We have changed things at the level that it's not backwards compatible.
Right. Say you want to talk to a database. PostgreSQL uses the same thing where I have some program that talks to PostgreSQL. If the major version changes, that means that the binary communication format between the client and the server has changed and I can't communicate anymore.
Right. And so you'd unlock the version. So like you've tested your application, you've written it all to PostgreSQL 7. Then you'd say, I don't want 7 to change, but I'm okay with the other numbers after the dot, after the two other numbers to change because that won't break me. So that's the idea is the second number, which is called the minor number, that means that things have been added to it, new features have been added, but nothing of the existing infrastructure has changed. So it's still backwards compatible, but there might be something you're not using yet. So you've added stuff to it. This is common in software where we'll say, oh, don't use this method. It's deprecated, meaning it's not really available for you anymore. You'd rather use this, but it's still there for you.
Yeah. On a per software package, things can be a little fuzzy around there depending upon what it's being used for. Like, for example, PostgreSQL, it's the on-disk format. That's usually the major version. But the feature set, you still need to do some changes with a minor version as well.
You don't need to necessarily do change. I mean, the general idea of Semver, if you abide by the Semver rules, number two, the second digit is the minor version when you add functionality in a backwards compatible manner.
Right.
So that's the idea behind it. Of course, all these cases are there could still be a bug inferred, right? I mean, just because I'm publishing a public API to my library and you're using it does not mean you're totally doing what I expect. So there could still be problems depending on the software it's built on. The third one's the patch. And the patch should theoretically only be for bug fixes, and it should never cause a problem with upgrading. You could always take the patch version.
Right.
Again, you might be using a side effect that I have in my software. And when I do a patch, I assume I'm doing a bug fix, and therefore it shouldn't break you. But if you were taking advantage of the problem that existed, it would break you. So it still can be a problem in some ways.
An example of this would be like jailbreaking a phone. Rooting it, where you are taking advantage of a flaw in order to get your software installed. They fix that flaw. It doesn't change the published usage of that API to get apps on your phone, but it breaks the ability to get full access to the device like
now,
you did before.
Now that we know these three numbers with regards to versioning, you'll start noticing that when you upgrade your phone software, sometimes it'll say, like recently iOS 10 is out now, right? And it is 10.0.1 is the current version, and that means that they had a patch already. Mm-hmm. You might not have even known of it, but it's out. I think it's .1. So in any case, keep in mind when you're looking at versions and what it actually means to have different numbers, and that major version of Firefox.
So pull this all the way back
please.
To web browsers, Firefox, Chrome, like when you say they're major numbers, I don't know that that's really the right way to describe it because browsers are a really interesting animal. Browsers basically have backwards compatibility back 15 years.
The dawn of time, yeah.
Right. I mean, a new browser still has compatibility with the DOM API, which no one really likes. Not everyone hates, but no one really likes.
but isn't that still the basis of how like jQuery works? It's still using the DOM API underneath.
But that's the thing, though, is jQuery is working around it, and jQuery isn't as fast as it could be,
right?
Because it has to deal with the DOM.
But I mean,
like things like query selector and query selector all were a direct result of jQuery doing these things and going,
that's a really good idea.
That.
That's part of the spec, but query selector and query selector are also part of the DOM interface. I mean, that's what it is. You're just thinking DOM.
No. The DOM API is a very specific thing, which is first child, get first child, get last child.
Oh, okay.
Get next sibling, get previous sibling.
You're talking like the original. But I think
get parent node.
I think the query selector is part of the DOM API now. I think that's what it is actually, because it actually is returning DOM nodes, isn't it? always recurring elements.
It does.
Yeah.
Which is different from the basic DOM API, which would return back live collections, live node collections.
Oh, I don't
know. Not live nodeless.
You mean yeah. nodeless that would actually change over time?
Yeah, you would get a reference to it, like say, get elements by tag name,
okay.
P. So give me all the paragraph tags. If you kept a reference to that,
across, it would change over time.
Yes.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
That thing that's like an array but is not really a JavaScript array.
Just don't iterate over it and expect it to be the same. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Which can have its uses, but it's more like this is a side effect that we're taking advantage of rather than
use. Here's a pointer into our memory space that's kind of dangerous. Good luck with that.
Query selector and query selector all, on the other hand, give back static lists.
Okay.
They are not live updated.
But if I delete that node from the DOM after I've given you that list, is that reference still a valid DOM node or is it has no parent?
Yes, this is the source of many memory leaks.
That's right. So you could actually hold on to it, and even though its parent is not actually part of the DOM, the document.
It has no parent.
Right, yeah. It has no parent. Because so when you delete it. So since you kept a reference, that's still there. So you got to be careful with that.
Yeah. Right.
You know, we should really do a podcast about programming. Because I love doing this stuff, but it's like it's got
to
be a push.
Oh. Yeah. But I do need to talk about this one last thing, which is...
Wait, I want to say one something about major and browsers and versions in general. Mm-hmm. This falls down very quickly because people are aware of version numbers, they become part of a marketing strategy sometimes. And sometimes they're completely, totally non-related to what actually is happening. A case in point of that is that you could be doing development internally to an application. I'm making like an application for a local restaurant in Santa Cruz. And as I develop that application, I'm doing minor versions and stuff while I'm playing with and all that. But at some point, I will submit it to the App Store, Apple App Store. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, I'll choose what version it changes, what version its number is. And as Apple builds and deploys it, there'll be a build number associated with it as well. I don't really control that number. And in some regards, it's not a part of my process. And the whole point of the versioning and stuff is about my internal process, mm-hmm. not about the public face of that. So these versions sometimes are – there's different types of them depending on where in the stack you are. So there's more complexity around them. And sometimes you're completely marketing.
The build number refers to a specific moment in time that the source code existed when it was made into a actual working product.
Right.
Whereas version numbers are the way that we as humans can identify them. Because most builds, which every build has a build number. Mm-hmm. Every state that your software in has a build ID. But not all of them get a special name.
Right.
Because most of the time it's like, fixed a typo.
Right.
I got rid of this bug that caused it to break.
Every time there's in the app that I work on at work, there's like 20 developers working on this or something like that. And every time they make a change, and all of them are making 5 or 6 changes a day easily, those don't all get numbers at any, but they all get builds, right? Or maybe some of them can condense into one because there's a machine system running that then tests them and such. And of course, that cycle of build and test, that next build might not happen until that whole test suite goes through. So you might skip 3 or 4 check-ins from multiple developers. And then at some point, we've kind of locked down to a version idea. And at that point, when we kind of push it forward into, okay, that's a special thing, that's what the version comes from.
Right. Yeah. So the thing I wanted to talk about just as a last item is one of the biggest arguments in programming circles for decades.
Semicolons?
This is
– Tabs or spaces?
That's
Vim or Emacs?
That's the one.
I knew I'd get to it. Wait, you're really going to talk to me about Vim and Emacs?
Yes.
Okay, what are you going to say?
Because
first off, do you use not that either of us are – we both use visual editors whenever we can, right?
Right.
You use Eclipse sometimes. I'm using like Xcode from Apple.
I mean, I learned how to code in Java when I was using Notepad on Windows.
Sure, you could do that. Go insane.
I got very good at Java doing that.
Eclipse, of course, is the kind of premier Java stack one. You also have like JetBrains makes a whole bunch of things like IntelliJ, which we use here. And then, of course, there's just good text editors like BBEdit, Sublime. I think Adobe has one called – what is Adobe's one? It's all web-based. It's really cool for hacking. I can't remember the name of it. You should try it.
There's Xcode for the Mac in the world and NetBeans. Yeah. There's no end of different editors and development environments. And they kind of early on split into two distinct groups.
Brackets is the Adobe one. Sorry.
Oh, okay. You got Vim or VI. VI improved because there was actually an older program called VI And everyone refers to it as VI, but I guess you can also call it Vim. This moved toward the minimalism. This was, it's an editor. I want you to get through this text file and editing it as quickly and simply as possible, but it doesn't do much in the way of other things. It's meant to be as simple as possible.
Okay.
It doesn't require many resources. Great. And then there's Emacs, which there's a joke about Emacs saying, pretty soon they'll make an editor for it. It's an operating system.
Right.
So because Emacs does everything.
Conceptually, Emacs is a text editor, word processor.
No, conceptually, Emacs is a Lisp interpreter.
Lisp, of course, is a programming language. Right. So you have like a Lisp interpreter engine with your editor, and people write modules for it, and mm-hmm. it becomes an extensive to the point where it's kind of an operating system, is what you're saying.
It does everything.
It's and almost like that.
To the point of this, most recent version of Emacs was released recently, Emacs 25.1.
Okay.
And now bear in mind that Emacs 1.0 came out a long time ago.
Did Stallman write it?
I believe so, yes.
When Stallman was on the show years ago, when we had him on the radio station, he was editing. He was working on, you know, a free BSD or some open source operating system, mm-hmm. and of course running his GNU kit because he wrote that and a lot of it, and was using Emacs to check his email and such. And he
using
was
a text editor to check your email.
Oh, absolutely. He had no windows open. He was flying through commands. It was very fluid. I mean, it was neat to see.
People browse the web in Emacs. People will do all sorts of crazy things with Emacs. Emacs is the Swiss Army knife du jour, I mean, of the command line.
I have
Until they made a graphical user interface of Emacs, in which case people just went like, yeah, let's go to the graphical version of this command line tool that does everything. That's where it comes into the joke of being, this is an operating system.
Yeah. Now, so the reason I asked Vim or Emacs is that I think most people I work with, if you sometimes use an editor that has to be command line, you use VI. If you live in an editor on command line, mm-hmm. you're using Emacs.
Yeah.
Right? But there are some Vim people that use it for everything.
Yeah, there are some outliers.
But in general, the people that are kind of like touch the command line sometimes and do git commits and things of that nature on command line, we use Vim, right? Like, and as you develop, you get to know Vim pretty well. If you step into Emacs, man, I can't even navigate through it. I can't figure it out. But in any case, why are you bringing this up?
Because they're still making versions of this. Like you would think, to the untrained eye, you might think, command line editors. Those are kind of a solved problem like 30 years ago. Like how do we edit files from a text interface? And yet they are still in active development. The last major version of Emacs 24.1, the current one is 25.1, was released a little more than 4 years ago.
Oh, so this is a big thing, every 4 years.
Right. The last version of Vim, which was version 7.4. Now the new version is 8.0, so a new major version. That was 10 years ago.
The 7 version? What, did they just release Vim?
Yeah, Vim version 8.0 was just released.
Do they do
and
that?
It's
just
10 years old.
Wow.
Now the thing is, what are they doing? Vim.
Yeah, wait, what are you adding to it? What do you need to add?
Vim has so many plugins now for it.
Mm-hmm.
That they've added a package manager.
That's great.
For the text editor.
Well, I mean, my text editor has a package manager. I use
and they've added, you know, like DirectX support on Windows.
I'm sorry. Wait a second. Why would you need DirectX support for a text editor? DirectX, by the way, is kind of like OpenGL. It's the graphics.
Because there are also versions of Vim that run in a graphical environment, but just with the Vim keyboard commands. So one of the things about these text editors is that they are very keyboard oriented.
Sure.
You're not using the mouse very often. So what happens if you live in a graphical world, especially if you're doing web development and the like, but you still pine for those days when you had no ability to do anything but the basic keyboard.
Okay, you're mocking a lot of this, but come on. I have definitely tried in Sublime, which of course is a visual and text editing engine tool. you can use your mouse for selecting lines and all that, but I will regularly select multiple lines with keystrokes and move them up and down and cut mm-hmm. them out. I mean, copy and paste. If you're using the mouse for copy and paste, you're wasting part of your life. I mean, do Command C and Command V. Like, it's easy. Those commands come, of course, from a text error, right?
Well,
but my point is that in that environment, sometimes because I know my Vim commands to navigate, I can imagine, you know, taking my visual editor and adding in Vim capability. But all it is like the movement, navigation, and insertion and editing things. That's the kind of stuff you'd want. It's not like you need all of it. Well, I guess grepping and stuff would be kind of nice. Anyway, I don't see the big deal of having Vim or Emacs type stuff in a visual editor.
Right. It also adds jobs that can be run based upon initiated from Vim.
You mean
timers,
like cron?
Timers. That would be like cron.
Yeah.
Emacs, on the other hand, adds in wonderful new facilities, for example, to play YouTube videos.
In your text editor?
Yes. It has a full-featured WebKit port embedded in Emacs so you can browse the internet and watch YouTube videos within Emacs.
Wait, what browser engine are they using?
WebKit. WebKit GTK. Yep.
Emacs, when you want your editor to do everything.
No, when you want an operating system and an editor to come along with it. And yes, we were giving them a hard time. And it's so funny because if you want to start a fight in programming circles, go like, man, I really love VI. Just wait to see what happens.
You know,
like, You're dropping a grenade in these geek parties.
The use of Emacs is generational. I don't know of any Emacs users here at the office, at the Netflix office. I'm sure there are some.
You ran into
a lot of Emacs users at Google?
I knew several at Google.
Were they older than you?
Huh. One of them was by like 1 year.
All right. Do you use Emacs or Vim or avoid them like the plague? Please do let us know. Just in the subject line Emacs and – you know, in the body, just say where you're from.
Yeah, I do use VI because it's like what you were talking about earlier. I need to get in, get out, and go do other things.
Geeks@geekspeak.org is the email address. It's an easy thing to use. One of the reasons, of course, is that Vim is installed automatically in OS X. So you already have VI.
Oh, I was saying I never use it on OS X.
You don't?
OS X, I just use a graphical text editor.
What if you're on the command line navigating and you want to open something?
That's the thing. Like, I don't have those cases. Most of those cases –
Wait a second. Right now, if I told you to put a file on your Apache web server that's already built into this thing, what would you do? Do that right now. Open your index.html document of your main Apache web server that's built in your operating system.
Oh, I don't have the – I'm not running the Apache on my local box.
Yeah, but it's there.
Okay. Then I would open up probably Text Wrangler is what I have open right now.
Okay. How would you open the file?
Command O, find the file.
Yeah. Where is it?
I actually don't know.
It's library. It's hidden. You can't see it in the text editor. Like, you need a command line. That's the reason.
That's the thing. The only time I've ever needed to do that, because I don't like doing it on my local box.
Right.
I will have a virtual machine with Linux, or I'll have my Raspberry Pi, which I've been doing a lot more stuff
with. And then you'll SSH into one of those.
And then I VI.
It's the only option, really. Or I guess there's like – what's the little tiny editor?
Unless I like make a Samba share on it or NFS or something like that.
What's the tiny editor?
Oh, Nano?
Nano. That's a good one, right?
Nano is one if you don't know VI or Emacs, because both VI and Emacs have an entry cost. Like, you need to learn the commands before you can do anything. You can't just like jump into them and start writing text. Like VI, literally, you start up VI and you start typing characters, nothing happens. And you start getting beeps or weird things.
Yeah, Nano's obviously better if you don't know VI.
Yeah.
Because in VI, you don't actually navigate with the cursor keys.
Nano actually has the commands at the bottom.
It does, but also for you to move your cursor around, you get to use the arrows,
You can do that in VI.
Can you?
Yeah. The thing is, VI has a curious thing where if you don't set your term type correctly, you can up, down, left, right in there if you're in escape mode. But if you're in insert mode, you can't. And yes, if you go like, wait, insert mode or escape mode? Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
You can navigate with the keys in VI. Of course, what you normally do is
if you have your term type set correctly and you have the right version of Vim, yeah. you can also in insert mode as well. But yeah, that's
I guess I have mine set up. I never use the cursors down there because they're up. Okay, so one of the points about all these, the Emacs and Vim, is that your key position is crucial. So instead of like changing your key mapping away from QWERTY because QWERTY is ridiculously stupid, we've all trained ourselves on it, so we never do that. But if you want to be able to navigate and do things with one hand, it's relatively easy to assign keystrokes that are under the fingers of your right hand to navigation. So in VI, your navigation is H, J, K, and L. And that's in a straight line. So if you want to actually know what that means, it means that yeah. J is down and K is up, and then H is left and L is right.
Yeah, H and L, left and right, makes sense. J and K is arbitrary. Which one's up and which one's down? Yeah, I guess exactly. We go down more often than we go up, so I guess be down.
You know what I always thought? The J has like a little bottom loop. And so I think, oh, it's going down that little loop.
You know what? I just hit the escape key and use the arrows. I'm sorry. I just
you don't use the controls? That's why I don't work at Google anymore.
Yeah. I can use – and I learned with HJKL, but mm-hmm. I just
– All right. Let's say you're in a 3D world and you're playing a character and you've got a mouse and you've got the keyboard. What's the movement for that?
3D world with a character and a mouse.
Yeah.
I'm WASD and shooting people.
Okay, so that totally makes sense, right? Because the W is up,
yes.
And the S is down,
yes.
Or backwards, whatever.
And A and D are left and right, respectively.
Totally fine. Why didn't they do that with Vim? Why wasn't it I to go up and K to go down?
Because
and
A is append to text. I is insert text. Is created.
You're answering why it can't be that way now. But when they first created it, they could have made like an arrow. Instead, it made a line. Who was like, navigation should be in a line? I mean, that's just stupid.
Because.
So I have a friend here at work that trained himself on a what's the other keystroke? Not QWERTY, but.
Dvorak.
He actually had a programming type of Dvorak. He mapped his own keys and he trained himself over time. He's now up to 80 words per minute on a remapped keyboard. But of course, the stickers or the numbers are wrong on the keyboard. So every once in a while, he'll mess up and just start typing. His hands will type in QWERTY and on his screen just is like, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, oh my God, what happened? Anyway.
Yeah, Dvorak's one of those ones where people said, like, oh, QWERTY is so inefficient. Dvorak will make you better. And when people learn Dvorak, the difference in speeds is not significant. It's not going to be the most pressing thing for how you do it. Not to mention the fact that all keyboards are basically QWERTY, meaning you go to someone else's desk and you're
crazy.
Screwed.
You're totally, it doesn't make any sense.
There is something to be said for uniformity.
Yeah. I got to say, the one thing that I don't like on my keyboard is that I use the control key. I mean, when you're programming, you do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I really should switch that to caps lock just for the strain on my pinky.
Yeah. Yeah, Vim, just another quick anecdote about it, something I find interesting is that you want to be in insert mode, like writing text, as little as possible. It's a weird thing to think about, but it's like I type in my text and I hit escape. Like it's automatic.
And then it's like you're doing something wrong if you're actually creating anything.
Right. It's like I go in, I do my thing, I'm like typing my stuff, okay, go, escape. Like escape is my default end of – of input, like if I'm pausing, like
you don't want to like do an arrow up or down with the wrong terminal, and all of a sudden have these weird, crazy characters.
Well, it's not just that; it's just like because you're going to want to move around. That's one of the things about coding is that you start typing and go, okay, now I need to put this into a new block. I need to indent this, all these characters and stuff like that. So it's like escape, and then you find out where you need to go, and then you have to decide, okay, do I insert? So I put the cursor where I'm starting, or do I put the cursor at the end of the text that I was just writing, the A for append, or do I do an O to open up a new line?
Wait. And the only time I ever do append mode is shift A, which takes you to the end of that line you're currently on and gives you an insertion. But append in line will cause you to overwrite stuff, right?
No.
No?
No.
It inserts. So what's the difference
between append? A is – it starts you start typing on the next character.
Right, and I is the character before.
Yeah.
Well, who cares? Why does it matter? Why do you need both types?
And then like O, you open up a new line and then you automatically start typing. Shift O is you open a new line above where you are and start typing. And like there it's it can be extremely efficient. Like the fact that you don't have to take your hand off the keyboard to have to move a mouse or touch a trackpad
absolutely.
Is extremely efficient. At the same time, it requires that you dedicate your life to an editor.
And I have to say,
and this is why the thing between VI and Emacs is so staunch, is because you've dedicated your life to an editor. Now someone says, no, I want you to learn another editor.
Right.
That feels like, you know,
being attacked.
Someone is like putting a gun to your children. You're like, no, I refuse.
There is something to be said, though, about training yourself to do something. I mean, once you've trained – I mean, for example, if you think of that as a bad thing, then you should switch away from QWERTY, right? Like, why not?
But Emacs is a completely different model from VI.
Yes.
There you're doing, you know, a bunch of meta commands to do whatever.
Yeah.
You know, alt meta butterfly flap, you know?
I think the level I get to is that I'm not irritated by what I'm doing. Right. If I'm at that level of proficiency in an editor, I'm fine. It's the times when I'm feeling lost or feeling like I can't do the thing I need to do efficiently, then I start training myself up. For example, this we do a lot of when we're squashing commits into one before we put on a master. I do interactive rebasing. I always do rebasing and interactive rebasing. Interactive rebasing shows you the list of commits. You do interactive rebase. And you give a hash or another branch name, and then it shows you all the commits that deviate from that point as separate lines. Mm-hmm. And the top one you have to pick as a basis, and then you can change the word pick. All the lines start with the word pick. And you can change those words to the word squash or just the letter S. But you have to delete the pick. And if you're going and you know you're going to squash all of them, and you just did it interactive for the heck of it, you can step through and change the word pick to S. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, in Vim, that's actually like two commands if you know if you know them well.
Right.
And since I started doing a couple years ago, I was doing that regularly. I got really good at that key command. It was like some amount replace and new character, and it was really quite easy.
Right.
Forward, delete. And all
I guess
that.
I think of when I'm just typing
but
text.
I've since then forgotten how to do that. Right. I'm now like I don't do it as much, and so I've forgotten the key commands.
For me, it's like I'm writing text. I go up and down, so I use the arrow keys an awful lot, no matter what editor I'm using. I want to make sure that the editor saves in UTF-8. That's paramount.
Are there editors that don't save in UTF-8?
Yes.
Why? Because you're not using VI. Okay, go on.
and then so I'll hold the shift key to select multiple characters, like, you know, shift down, select the whole line, that type of thing. But when I ever have to do anything more complex, for example, in VI, if I were going to do a search and replace.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a bad example.
Colon S percent. You know, start putting in my my regular expression, and you know, and
first
that's fine.
First, do it with a fine so you don't mess up. Right, it's so much easier.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But I can do like Command F, and then I go to the search and I like check the regex box.
Yeah, and you get like a fields and like places to write.
Generating
so
the regex is so much more of the search process than whether or not I'm hitting Command F and opening up a window and clicking on it with a mouse, as opposed to colon S percent. Like it, the text editor doesn't give anything to me.
I agree.
If I'm spending a bunch of time going, okay, I need multiple space characters. Oh, wait, they might be any type of white space. Let me do a backslash S plus.
Yeah. Also, a good editor nowadays will give you your search field. And as you type your regex, it'll actually highlight the text that it's matching.
Yeah.
So it's really fast.
But there's a plugin for that for Vim and for Emacs.
Sure there is. If you want to spend your life doing that. Maybe we should have had like an
but
Emacs
I mean,
or Vim.
But I mean, the advantages
the
that people say for Vim and Emacs, which is keeps your hands on the home keys. Mm. It keeps your hands there. They're real. I just haven't found them to be so definitive in terms of making a difference in my day.
Right. Well, keep in mind that they were created prior to a pointer existing.
No, they
so
were.
So at that point, they're kind of essential.
Yeah, they were, but we have them now.
We do, and we don't need
– Yeah, I mean Vim was created in an era where computers – like you had a dumb terminal and you connected up to – a larger Unix machine that had, at maximum, you know, a few megabytes of memory.
Sure.
And that's just not the world we live in anymore.
Right.
I mean, I have 16 gigabytes of RAM on my laptop.
Yeah, but on your Raspberry Pi, you don't. And the only way to really get in the Raspberry Pi is through SSH, and so you're still using Vim. So it's appropriate for the right location.
That's also what I mean, though, is that there are ways of – yeah, anyway.
Well, thanks, Miles. That was fun.
So we got a little geeky at the end for folks.
Yay. See you next week. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Oh, you're asking if I'm actually going to show up again. No, this is it. This is the end. We've had the conversation about Vim versus Emacs on air. We're done.